the first question. Your last words at this morning's discourse were, meditate on this. What do you mean? How does one who only knows how to think about things learn to meditate on things? Knowing what thinking is the beginning of knowing what meditation is. Thinking is the negative part. Meditation is the positive part. Thinking means mind in turmoil. Meditation means mind in silence. But the turmoil is the beginning of silence. And only after the storm, there is silence. If you can think, then you are capable of meditation. If a man can be ill, then he can be healthy. Health becomes impossible only when you cannot even be ill. Then you are dead. Only a corpse cannot fall ill. If you can fall ill, then there is still hope. Then you are still alive. And so is the case with thinking and meditation. Thinking is mind ill, not at ease, not reconciled with itself, disturbed, fragmented, divided. Meditation means the division is no more. The fragments have disappeared into oneness. You are at ease at home. It is the same mind. Divided, it becomes thinking. Undivided, it becomes meditation. If you can think, then you are capable of meditation. Although meditation is not thinking. Thinking is an ill state of affairs, a pathology. But one can transcend it. And the transcendence is easy. It is not difficult as you think. The difficulty comes because you really don't want to go into meditation. Because in meditation, only thinking is not going to disappear. You are also going to disappear. Only an ill man is, a healthy man disappears. In health, you are not. You exist only in illness. You exist only in pain, in suffering, in hell. You can't exist in heaven. Because to feel one's existence means to feel pain. Have you not observed it? When you have a headache, then you have a head. When the headache disappears, the head disappears too. If your body is perfectly healthy, and everything is running smoothly, humming smoothly, you don't feel the body at all. You become bodiless. In the ancient Indian scriptures, health is described and defined as bodilessness. You don't feel your body. How can you feel your body if it is not ill? Only illness creates knowledge. Self-consciousness is created by it. Self is created by it. So meditation is not difficult if you really want to go into it. It is the simplest thing possible, the most simple, the most primal. In your mother's womb, you were in meditation. There was no distracting thoughts. You were not thinking about anything. You simply were. To regain that state of womb is what meditation is all about. When you see a person meditating, what do you see? He has disappeared into the womb again. He has made his whole body like a womb and he has disappeared into it. Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, what he is doing? He has moved back to the source. He is not there. There is nobody sitting under the Bodhi tree. That's what a Buddha means. There is nobody sitting under the Bodhi tree. When Jesus goes to the mountains, away from the multitudes, where he is going? He is going inwards. He is trying to make a contact again with the original source. Because from that original source is rejuvenation. From that original source there is again freshness, vitality. And the waters of life are flowing again. One is bathed. One is resurrected. In the world, thinking is needed. In your inner being, thinking is not needed. When you are communicating with somebody, thought is a must. When you are just communing with your own self, what is the need of thought? Thought will be a disturbance. Try to understand why thinking is needed and what thinking is. When there is a problem, thinking is needed to solve it. You have to go round about, look from every angle of the problem, think all possible solutions, and then there are many alternatives, so one has to choose which one is the right. And there is always possibility of the error. And still no guarantee that you are going to succeed to find the solution. One gropes in the darkness. One tries to find out a way out of it. Thinking is confronting a problem. In life there are millions of problems and thinking is needed. I am not saying that thinking is not needed. It is needed. When you relate with the outside, it is needed. But when you are facing your own being, it is not a problem. It is a mystery. And let it be very clear what a mystery is. A problem is something that can be solved. A mystery is something that cannot be solved by its very nature. There is no way out of it. So there is no question of finding the way. You are a mystery. It is never going to be solved. Because you cannot go behind yourself, how can you solve it? You cannot stand outside yourself and tackle yourself as a problem. So how can you solve it? Who is going to solve whom? You are the solver, and you are the problem, and you are the solution. There is no division at all. The knower and the known and the knowledge are one. This is mystery. When the knower is different from the known, then there is a problem. Then there is something objective there. You can think a way out. You can find out something which becomes knowledge. But inside yourself, you are facing the eternal, the beginningless, the endless. You are facing the ultimate. You cannot think. If you think, you will miss. Only through non-thinking, you will not miss. You can only see into it with awe, with great wonder. You can go into it deeper and deeper. You can dive into it. You can go on digging. And the more you dig, the more you will understand that this is a mystery to be lived, not a problem to be solved. So thinking is irrelevant. And when thinking is irrelevant, there arises meditation. The failure of thinking is the arousal of meditation. Science is thinking, religion is meditation. If you think about God, it is philosophy, it is not religion. If you live God, then it is religion. If you are looking at a lotus flower and thinking about it, then it is science, philosophy, aesthetics. But if you are simply looking at the lotus flower, the look is pure, uncontaminated by any thought. And the lotus flower is not thought to be a problem, but just a beauty to be experienced. You are there, but the lotus flower is there, and there is nothing in between. Just empty. Nobody is standing between you and the flower. It is meditation. Then flower is not outside you, because there is nothing to divide as the in and the out. Then the lotus flower is somehow within you, and you are somehow within the lotus flower. You melt into each other. Divisions are lost. Boundaries become blurred. The lotus starts touching your heart, and your heart starts touching the lotus. There is communion. It is meditation. Whenever thought is not functioning, it is meditation. Listening to me, sometimes it becomes meditation to you. I say sometimes, because sometimes you start thinking and then you lose track. When you are just listening, not thinking at all what is being said, neither far nor against, not comparing with your past knowledge, not being greedy to accumulate it for your future use, not trying to justify, rationalize, not doing anything at all. I am here, you are there, and there is a meeting. In that meeting is meditation. And then there is great beauty. You asked me, your last words at this morning's discourse were, meditate on this. Yes. Whether I say it or not, that is my everyday's message. In the beginning, in the middle, in the end. That's what I am saying. Meditate on this. Meditate. The English word meditation is not very adequate to what we mean by dhyana in the East. The meditation again carries some idea of thinking. In English, meditation means to think about, to meditate upon something. Dhyana does not mean to meditate upon something. Dhyana simply means to be in presence of something. Just to be in presence. If you are in presence of a tree, it is meditation on the tree. If you are in presence of the stars, then it is meditation on the stars. If you are here in presence with me, then it is a meditation. And when you are alone and just you feel your own presence, that is meditation. From dhyana came the Chinese word chana. From chana came the Japanese word zen. They are all derivations of dhyana. Dhyana is a beautiful word. It is not translatable in English, because English has words like meditation, contemplation, concentration. They all miss the point. Concentration means concentrating on one thing. Meditation is not a concentration. It is an absolutely deconcentrated state of consciousness. It is just the opposite. When you concentrate, there is a tension. You start focusing. There is effort. And when you concentrate on one thing, then other things are denied. Then you are closed for other things. If you concentrate on me, then what you will do with this plane passing by and the noise? Then you will close your mind to it. You will focus on me, you will become strained, because you have to deny this roaring aeroplane. You have to close your mind to it. Then your mind is not open. What you will do? A bird starts singing. You will have to close yourself. That's what is being taught in the schools and the colleges and the universities. It is concentration. Meditation is not concentration. It is just openness, alertness, presence. You are listening to me, but you are not listening to me exclusively. You are simply listening. And the aeroplane goes roaring. You listen to that too. And the bird starts singing, and you listen to that too. And there is no division. You don't choose. All that happens in the surroundings is accepted. It becomes part of your listening to me. Your listening is not exclusive. It is inclusive of all. So concentration is not meditation. Then the word meditation itself is not meditation. Because in meditation, somebody meditates on Jesus. Somebody meditates on the Bible. Somebody meditates on God. Again, it is not meditation. If there is a God as an object and Jesus as an object, then there is a distinction between the knower and the known. There is duality. And in duality, there is conflict. And in conflict, there is misery. In non-duality, conflict disappears. And when conflict disappears, hell disappears. Then there is joy. So meditation is not meditating upon something. Meditation simply means a different quality of your inner being. In thinking, your mind goes on weaving, spinning thoughts. In meditation, your mind is simply silent, utterly silent, not doing anything at all, not even meditating, not doing anything at all, sitting silently, doing nothing, and the grass grows by itself. The spring comes, and the grass grows by itself. Meditation is a natural state of silence. It is not contemplation either. In contemplation, you think about high thoughts, spiritual things, not about mundane things, not about the markets, not about the family, but high values, truth, beauty, bliss. But you contemplate on these. You try to think about these high values of life. Then it is contemplation. But meditation is not even that. Meditation is a state of stillness. And this state of stillness has not to be forced, because it cannot be forced. If you force it, it will not be the right stillness. If you force it, you will be there forcing it. It will not be natural. It will not be spontaneous. So what has to be done? One has to understand the ways of thinking. One has to understand the stupidity of thinking. One has to understand that thinking creates conflict, division, struggle, that thinking fragments you, that in thinking you start falling apart. One has to see what thinking does to you. In that very seeing arises meditation. In that very understanding, suddenly you feel breezes of silence coming to you. For a moment, everything becomes still. Utterly still, stand still, and the taste of it will bring more of it. And by, you will know the knack of it. Meditation is a knack. It is not science, it is not even art. It is a knack. You have to learn it slowly, slowly, by your own experience. When I say meditate on this, I mean don't think upon it. Just close your eyes. Be in silence. Let it be there. For example, the Jesus story. Jesus is standing on that well, Jacob's well, and the woman of Samaria, and Jesus is asking, give me some water to drink. And the dialogue that ensues, just let it be there, and you be utterly silent in front of this parable. Let this parable be like a lotus flower. It is just let it be there, throbbing, pulsating, with a beating heart. Let it become alive in front of you, and then become silent. What can you do? You can only be silent. Let this drama be enacted in front of you. In deep silence you see it, and that will reveal to you the meaning of it. and that will reveal to you all the dialogues that have happened between any enlightened person and the disciple. And it will become not only a Jesus parable, it will become a parable between you and me too. It is happening every day. That's what I mean when I say meditate upon this. The second question, when you speak of the need for trust in order to let go of ego, I felt that that is where I am stuck. For my distrust is a tangible thing. It feels painful, but I can't let go of it. Early this year, for a brief period, I felt high energy and with it open, loving and trusting. But now that energy has gone, and with it the openness. Always remember that when I am saying something, I am not giving you an order to do it. If you take it that way, you have already missed the point. I am simply making it clear to you. Don't be in a hurry to practice it. Whatever I am saying has nothing to do with practicing it. You have just to understand it. Around me, only thing that is going to help you is clarity, transparency. When I am talking about the ego, don't jump ahead. Don't start in thinking how to drop this ego. Yes, Bhagwan is right. This ego is creating the trouble. So how to drop it? You have not attained to clarity. You have gone into greed. You have become ambitious. Rather than understanding what was being said to you, you made it a desire. And now you will be in trouble. While I am talking about the ego, listen meditatively. Listen totally. Just see the point of it, what is being said. There is no hurry. There is nothing to be done. Nothing to be practiced. Don't bring the tomorrow in. Don't bring the next moment even. Don't bring the future, because with the future comes the desire. And with the desire, the whole hell is let loose. While listening to me, if you start thinking how to do it, yes, it looks beautiful. And if I can do it, there will be great joy in me. How to do it? And while you are thinking how to do it, I am talking about the ego, and you are not listening anymore. And the ego can be dropped only when your clarity is complete, entire. You cannot drop it. You are it. How can you drop it? But while listening, totally, silently, meditatively, you are not. There is clarity. In that clarity, something will click. You will see it so 100% that that very thing will become a transformation. Not that tomorrow you will have to drop it. No, tomorrow you will not find it there. Not that next moment you have to go home and practice how to drop the ego. I am not teaching you yoga exercises. These are not yoga postures that you have to prepare and rehearsal and practice and discipline yourself. What I am doing here is sharing my enlightenment with you, my clarity with you. I have a clarity. I am inviting you to come and share with my clarity. In that very sharing, something will change in you. That sharing is alchemical. Next moment you will be surprised. The ego is not there. Not that you have to drop it. You understood the point. You understood the foolishness of it, the ridiculousness of it, the absurdity of it. Now what is there to leave and what is there to renounce? Ego is not some entity in you that you have to drop it. It is not something like cancer that you have to operate or be operated for it. It is just an illusion. It is like in the dark night you see a rope and you think it is a snake. And you become very much frightened. And you start running. And you have breathlessness, and you are perspiring. And I come across, and I say to you, I know it perfectly well, it is not a snake, it is a rope. You come along with me. And you go on asking, or thinking, how to kill that snake. And I am saying it is not a snake, come along with me and see. And here is the light and the lamp, and we will go together, and we will have another look. And I know, I have been there, and I have known that rope. Once I also used to know it as a snake, and I also used to get very much frightened, just like you. So I understand, I'm not laughing at your misery. I feel compassion, because I know I was in the same situation myself. But you come along with me, and you are asking, Bhagwan, how to kill that snake? Should we take a gun with us, or just a stick will do? Or there are rocks around, we can use the rocks and kill the snake? And constantly, and I am saying, there is no snake, there is only one rope, but you are not listening. And you ask, when we have reached, what we are to do? Even if you are not saying in so many words, deep inside you are thinking about it. And you are still afraid. And you are not walking courageously. You are hiding behind me. And you say, who knows, it may be a snake after all. And how can I trust this man? Maybe he is mad. Because I have seen with my own eyes, it is a snake and a very dangerous one. This is the situation. When I say the ego is a shadow, you have certainly seen it, but it is not an entity. You have certainly been suffering from it, yet it is illusion. I can understand your problem. You say, how can one suffer from something which is not? It looks very logical. How can one suffer from something which is not? If one suffers, then the logical mind says, the cause of suffering must be there because the effect is there. But can't you suffer from a rope thinking it as a snake? Have you not suffered in your dreams? Have you not suffered by your own delusions, projections? You have suffered. Many a time you have suffered from a cause which doesn't exist, but it can create the effect. You can fall ill. If somebody says that the water that you have just now drunk is poisonous, you can start vomiting. And if so many people say that, yes, it is poisonous, if the whole town says it is poisonous, if the whole world says it is poisonous, then the more and more your illusion is supported, nourished. And this is what is happening. You are suffering from an illusion called the ego. And the whole world said, yes, it is there. And not only the world, your so-called religious people, Mahatmas, saints, they also say, it is very dangerous, this ego. This has to be dropped. This has to be crushed and killed. This is the enemy, they also say. And they devise techniques, strategies, how to kill it. The whole world believes in it. The people who are worldly, they believe in it. And the people who are called spiritual, they believe in it. Somebody follows it, somebody fights with it. But they both believe in it. As far as the belief is concerned, they both agree. What I am doing is a totally different thing. I am saying the ego exists not. I am not saying that you drop it. How can you drop it? It is not there in the first place. And if you start dropping a thing which is not, you will be in trouble. You will not be able to drop it. And so you will become very much miserable. And you will do hard efforts to drop it, and you will again and again find that you have not dropped it. Then more and more frightened, more and more miserable, and you will start feeling very inferior. You cannot do a simple thing, dropping the ego. Nobody has ever been able to drop the ego. Let it be remembered, nobody has ever been able to drop the ego. What do I mean by it? Has not Buddha dropped it? Has not Jesus dropped it? No, not at all. They have only understood that it is not. They have seen through and through, and they laughed. They were simply running from something which is not there. In that understanding, it disappears. And many times it disappears in your life too, in spite of you. Sometimes in deep love it is not. Hence the joy of love. It is not really the joy of love, it is the joy of the disappearance of the ego. Sometimes in prayer, sometimes in meditation, sometimes seeing nature, watching the sea, or sometimes just looking at the stars. It happens. And there is great benediction. One is forward. But it comes for only for moments. Because you don't understand even then what is happening. Again, it is lost. When it is lost, you become very miserable. And you start thinking how to get it again. How to go into that space again. It was not that you had gone into that space. It was simply that because you became so enchanted with the stars, that for a moment you forgot your old obsession. The obsession of the ego. You became so enchanted with the stars that you forgot the rope and the snake. It was just a forgetfulness. But how long you can remain enchanted with the stars? Sooner or later you will have to come back, and the rope is there, waiting as a snake. And you are again frightened. Sometimes in love with a woman or a man, looking into the eyes of a beloved, it disappears. But how long? The honeymoon cannot be very long. sooner or later, you know those eyes, you know that woman, you know that man. And then by and by, you start settling back into your old so-called reality. And the rope is there, which looks like a snake to you. This is the situation, you say. The question is from Bodhiprem. When you speak of the need for trust in order to let go of ego, you misunderstand me. You are saying when you speak of the need for trust in order to let go of the ego, you are saying that I say to you, trust so that you can drop the ego. I'm not saying that. I'm saying if you trust, the ego is dropped. It is not like cause and effect, that you trust will be the cause and the ego will be dropped as an effect. I'm saying the moment you trust, the ego is not there. In trust, the ego is not found. But you are so much concerned with the ego, you say, okay. If you say in trust it is not found, I will trust in order so that the ego is not found. That in order you are bringing in. Please be very careful, because what is being said to you is immensely significant. Don't change it. Don't interpret it. Let it be as it is said to you. I am not saying trust in order so that the ego can be dropped. Otherwise your trust will be a means and the dropping of the ego will be an end. Naturally the end will be in future. And the means has to be practiced. You will have to practice for years or for life. And when you have come really to gain trust, then you will be able to drop the ego. No, I am saying this very moment. If trust is there, ego is not there. They don't exist together. It is like the room is dark. And I tell you, take this lamp. And you say, if I take this lamp into the room, how long it will take for the darkness to disappear? If I go in the room and practice light there, how long it will take for the darkness to disappear? You need not practice anything. You simply take the light there and you will not find darkness there. They don't exist together. What is trust? It is the highest kind of love. It is the purest love. It is uncontaminated love, uncontaminated by any desire. If you trust me with a desire, it is not trust. Then you are using me. If you think trusting in me, you will attain to nirvana, moksha, kingdom of God. Then you don't trust me. You are using. You have made a means of me. That's not very respectful. If you trust me, this is your kingdom of God. This trust. There is nothing else. There is nowhere to go. This is your nirvana. In this very trust, darkness has disappeared and the light is burning bright. Bodhiprem says, when you speak of the need for trust in order to let go of ego, now he is creating a great problem. I felt that when that is where I am stuck. You are stuck because of your misunderstanding, unclarity. It is not the ego that is obstructing you. It is the unclarity. It is because you have not been present to me. It is because you have not been listening to me without desires. It is not the ego that you are stuck with. It is your unintelligence. Now that will hurt you. Because it is okay to be stuck with ego, but to be stuck with unintelligence, that will hurt very much. Am I unintelligent? You can accept the idea that you are an egoist, but to accept the idea that you are unintelligent is very difficult. Your ego will say, you an unintelligent Bodhiprem? You are the most intelligent person in the world. That's what Bodhiprem must be saying right now. But be patient. Try to understand. We are stuck because of our unintelligence. Call it sleep. Call it ignorance. Call it whatsoever you want to call. But basically it is unintelligence. An intelligent person. And I don't mean that there are intelligent persons and there are intelligent persons, unintelligent persons. Every intelligent person carries the potential of being an intelligent person. Unintelligence is just the seed which has not broken its cell yet. Once the cell is broken and the seed starts sprouting, it becomes intelligence. So unintelligence is not against intelligence. It is the very womb intelligence arises out of. But let me tell you that a spade is a spade. Even if it hurts, one has to understand it. It is unintelligence which hinders us. Intelligence becomes freedom. You have not understood me. Out of your unintelligence, you are creating desires. Former distrust is a tangible thing. It is not distrust. Because you have not known even trust, how can you distrust? Let it be very clear to you. Distrust is possible only when you have known trust. You have not known trust, so distrust is not possible. Then what it is there? It is untrust, not distrust. And that is a different thing. It is untrust. What is the difference? Untrust simply means you have never tried trust, so you are afraid, frightened. Everybody is frightened when something new one is going to do, when one enters in an uncharted sea. Or goes into a jungle where are no more any maps available, no milestones, and there is every possibility that you will never come across any other human being, so that you can ask where to go and how to find the way. I have heard in a jungle it happens. A man was lost, an explorer, for 3 days, hungry, almost getting crazy, and running from this place to that, and reaching nowhere. 4th day, early in the morning, he saw another man sitting under a tree, He was overjoyed. He forgot all those 3 days of suffering. In the night he could not sleep for 3 days because of the wild animals. And in the day, searching and searching, and there was no way to find out how to get out of this jungle. It was appearing endless. Naturally, if you were that explorer, you would have also overjoyed. You must have become full of joy seeing another human being now. He just hugged the man and says, "I am so happy." And the man who was sitting under the tree, he said, "For what?" And this explorer said, "Just seeing you, because for 3 days I have been lost." And the man says, "So what? I have been lost for 7 days. Now, even if you can find a human being who is himself lost, what is the point of finding him? Now you both will be lost together, that's all. Maybe even more lost, because now there will be two persons continuously conflicting. Up to now you were alone, at least free to move on your own. Now you have a marriage partner. Now there is going to be more problems, because he would like to go to north and you would like to go to south. And both will create fear into the other. Maybe the other is right and I am going wrong. And both may create guilt into each other. It is a natural fear of the unknown that creates untrust. It is not distrust. Distrust means you trusted and you were cheated. You trusted and because of your trust you were deceived. Then distrust. But trust has never cheated anybody. It cannot. And I am not saying that through trust people cannot cheat you. Remember, I am saying trust never cheats anybody. Sometimes it has happened that a disciple has become enlightened because he trusted the master and the master was himself not enlightened. This strange thing has been happening down the ages many times. It happens in a Tibetan mystic's life. He went to a master. The master was a fraud. And frauds exist in the world of spirituality more than anywhere else. Because there it is very easy to cheat. Because they deal in invisible things. You cannot see. They say, "Here is God, look into my hand." If you don't see, they say, "You don't trust." If you see, they say, "Then perfectly okay. Can't you see?" And you say, "Yes, sir." And you are not seeing. When you deal in invisible goods, it is very simple to cheat. In the marketplace, there are frauds, but not so many. They cannot be there so many, because they deal in visible goods. There is some way, some criterion to judge whether the thing is right or wrong. But there is no way to judge. So in religion, out of 199% are frauds. It is the best way to cheat people. Nothing like it. This mystic went to the master, and the master was a cheat. But this young man trusted utterly. He thought his master is enlightened. And whatsoever the master said, he followed 100%. It was rumored around the place that the master is such a great man that even if you repeat his name and walk on the water, you can walk. Nobody has tried it before. And even if somebody had tried, then he must have been drowned. And then there is always a rationalization that your trust is not entire. So you cannot catch hold of the Master. Your trust is not entire. That's why you were drowned. This young man walked on the water. And really he walked. And that became his usual thing. When you can walk on the water, who bothers to go to the bridge or things like that? People started coming and seeing him, and the other disciples, particularly the senior ones, became very much disturbed. They tried in secret, but they were all drowned. So, even the master was puzzled. One day, in the secret, the master tried himself, thinking that when my disciples can walk on the water just by trusting in me, then what I cannot do? I can do anything. I'm the greatest master in the world. My disciples are walking on water. Jesus used to walk on water, and my disciples are walking on water. So I must be greater than Jesus. So he went, of course, in secret, because he was afraid. He had never tried. Who knows? And he knew perfectly well that he is a fraud. The disciple had deep trust in him, but he had no trust in himself. How can he have any trust? He knows perfectly well that he goes on deceiving people. He walked and was drowned. Then he called the young man and said, how do you do it? He said, I simply say your name. Master, I want to go to the other side. And you take me. And recently I have started flying from one peak of the mountain to the another. Because I said, when it is possible in water, why not in air? And one day I tried and said, Master, take me from this side to the other side. And you took me. Now I can do anything. Just your name. The master has to fall into his feet. And he said, you initiate me. You know the secret. I'm an ordinary man. And last night I tried walking. And I was drowned. It has happened many times. Because it is not really the question whether the man you trust is cheating you or not. The question is that trust never cheats. You cannot be cheated because of your trust. If the trust is infinite, you are impossible to be cheated. Nobody can cheat you. Your trust will protect you. Your trust will become your very experience. Your trust will become your boat. Your trust will take you to the other shore. But remember, what you have is not distrust. You can't have distrust. You have never trusted. Distrust can come only as an experience that trust failed. But trust never fails. So distrust is just a word. Untrust is true. You have never tried. So only just a little courage is needed to try. Give it a try. Be a little courageous. Slowly, slowly go beyond the limitations that you have created around yourself. one step by step. And the more you go beyond the barriers that you have created around yourself, the more bigger you become, more expense comes to your consciousness, then you will see that you can go as far as you want, because every move beyond the limitation brings more joy, more freedom, more being. Karma distrust is a tangible thing. It is not distrust, it is only fear, which is tangible. It feels painful, but I can't let go of it. There is no need to let go of it. Meditate on it. See what exactly it is. We go on giving names to things which we have not even watched correctly. And once you give a wrong name, you will be in a trap. The wrong name will never allow you to see the thing as it is. Don't be in a hurry to name a thing and categorize a thing and pigeonhole a thing. There is no need. You just watch what it is. If you watch, you will find it is untrust, not distrust. If you watch, you will find it is simply a lack of courage, fear, not distrust and tangible, no. Then things will be different. When you know it is fear, when the disease is known rightly, a right medicine is possible. When you go on calling your TB cancer, then you go on treating cancer and the TB is never treated. Diagnosis is far more important than medication. And this is the problem. People don't worry about diagnosis and they are simply ready to jump upon any medicine. They are ready to take any medicine without bothering at all what exactly is their disease. And that is the 90% problem. Medicine is only 10%. Diagnosis is needed. And that's why a master can be helpful to diagnose things. I would like you to remind that it's untrust, not distrust. That it is fear. And in a way natural. It exists in everybody. So don't start feeling yourself a coward. It is natural. The fear of the unknown exists in everybody. And one has to go slowly, slowly, beyond the known, just few steps, so that if it becomes too much, you can come back. But once you have started going, it is the same fear. When a new bird is ready to go into the sky and is afraid, sitting just on the edge of the nest, the wings are there. He can fly, but he has never flown before. So a untrust, not distrust, untrust, maybe I cannot make it. Maybe I will fall. Can I really go into this beautiful sky? He flutters his wings, tries to gather courage, and still remains there, hanging. And the mother pushes him. The mother goes flying around the nest to show him that, look, I can fly. Why can't you? You come from me. You are just like me. Look at my wings. You have far more beautiful wings. My wings are old, yet I can fly. Your wings are young. You can go far away, farther than me. You just see. And the mother goes on flying, comes back to the nest, looks into the eyes of the child, pushes him, nags him. That's what I go on doing, nagging. And sometimes it is, if it is needed, she really physically pushes him, throws him out of the nest. And he starts, of course, in a haphazard way because he has never done before. Not in a very skillful way, not very aesthetic, not very artistic. It is natural. Just a few seconds fluttering around, comes back to the nest. Still fear is there, but now trust has started coming up. Now he knows that he is not very skillful, but he has wings. Then skill can be learned. Now next time he will not need mother's push. Next time he will tell to the mother, you just sit here and see. And I am going to take a trip. And he takes first around the nest, then around the tree, then he starts going to other trees, and then one day he is gone. This is the way a disciple moves. It is fierce and natural. I understand it. Don't be worried about it. But don't misname it. Otherwise, things will be difficult. You will go on fighting with distrust. And the problem is fear, not distrust. And you will go on fighting with ego. And the problem is unintelligence, not ego. Early this year, for a brief period, I felt high energy with it. Open, loving and trusting. But now that energy has gone, and with it the openness. Now understand something, it has happened to you. So you have been out of the nest. You have been on a small trip. Maybe it was very small. But you have tasted it. Now watch how it did happen that time. And why it is not happening now. There are a few things. First, when it happened for the first time, you were taken unawares. You were not waiting for it, and it has happened. Now, because it has happened, you are waiting and desiring. That desire may be one of the barriers. These things come on their own. They are happening. Happiness is a happening. You cannot bring them by force, by coercion, by violence. You cannot bring them in your life. They come on their own. You have just to be open for them to come. Your doors should remain open when the breeze comes. Enjoy it. But you cannot go out and force the breeze to come in. For the first time it happens, it is always easy for the first time, and second time difficult. It is not only so with you, it is with everybody. People who come here, when they come for the first time, they are not expecting. They don't know what is going to happen. They are simply open. They only know that something may happen. So keep the doors open. When the first time they come and fall in love with me, there is a kind of honeymoon. They are utterly in tune with me. Soaked in a new kind of awareness. Feeling a new hope, again feeling alive, dullness has disappeared, again one door opens. Otherwise they were thinking that there is nothing in life, there is no meaning. The poetry had disappeared long before. Again, they start pulsating. again hope. Again they can feel that there is still some possibility. They become expectant without any expectation. Just expectant. Something is possible. What they don't know. And the first impact, and their mind is not able to cope with it, so the mind becomes silent. The thing is so new that they cannot control it. Meditations, listening to me, and the whole Orange family around here, the whole vibe simply turns them on. And things start happening. The moment things start happening, the problem arises. Then they start desiring for more. And the moment you desire, things stop. When the more comes, the mind has come back. The greed has come back. You are no more in the present, you have moved in the future. And when you ask that the same thing should be repeated again and again, you are hanging with the past. Now you are no more here. Listening to me, by and by, their mind becomes knowledgeable. They become great knowers. That too becomes a barrier. Listening to me become more and more unknowing. That is the whole effort here. I want to take your all knowledge away from you. I want to destroy it. I want you to be ignorant, innocent. Because in innocence, all is possible. With knowledge, nothing is possible. But listen to me again and again and again. You become knowledgeable. Even about these things, that one has to be ignorant. It becomes your knowledge. Not that you become ignorant, you start teaching others to be ignorant. One has to be innocent. This becomes your knowledge. You don't become innocent. You become knowledgeable about innocence. You start talking about innocence, what innocence is, and how it should be brought. You become experts, but you miss the point. And then things close. The honeymoon is over, and the dark night of the soul starts. Bodhi Prem is in the dark night of the soul. But try to understand it. And in the very understanding, it will start disappearing. And the morning is not far away. Next time, when it happens, Bodhi Prem, and it will happen. It will happen only when you are tired of your desire and you forget about it. It will happen only when the past is so far away and distant that you start thinking, maybe it had never happened in the first place. Maybe I was dreaming. I was in a kind of hallucination. Or I had read in a book. Or maybe I got deceived by Bhagavan or something. I was hypnotized. When it will become so distant that you cannot really think it has happened to you, then you will lose the grip on the past. And if it had not happened, then what is the point of desiring more of it? How can you desire more of something which has not happened to you? Then the future will disappear. This dark night of the soul become darker, darker, darker. A moment will come, all hope will disappear. And with that disappearance of the hope and the past and the desire for the future, all that you have gathered around here, the knowledge, will look meaningless. You will think so, it doesn't work. It is meaningless. You will start dropping that knowledge too. Then, the morning. Then suddenly one day you see it is again there. The sun has risen. and the fragrance is coming from many, many unknown flowers. You are again full of it. And the second time it will be deeper than the first. Now, I would like you to remember that when it happens second time, don't do the same mistake that you did the first time. Next time when it comes, enjoy it, feel thankful and grateful, and when it goes, say goodbye, and don't be bothered by it. It will come and go for many times before it settles permanently. It will come and go many times. So it is not going to be solved within 2-3 times. It may come many times. And if you go on doing the same mistake again and again, then it may go on coming and going for many lives. Next time, be a little more alert. Don't desire. Don't expect. When it comes, feel thankful, because you have not earned it. It is a gift. A gift cannot be desired. A gift cannot be earned. It comes to you as a gift. But it happens with gifts too. If somebody gives you a gift every birthday, and now your birthday is coming, and you are thinking, now what he is going to give? And naturally you desire more than the last time. The last time he had given you a bicycle, now you want a car. And if the car is not coming, then you will be very angry. In fact, if the bicycle comes, then too you will be very angry. What to do with the bicycle? Once is enough. Now again the bicycle. And if even the bicycle is not coming, then you will be in a rage. And you don't understand the point that it was a gift. You cannot expect it. It was a gift. When it comes, you have to be thankful. When it does not come, you cannot demand it. Gifts cannot be demanded. And God comes as a gift. Light comes as a gift. Love comes as a gift. Life itself is a gift. You cannot demand it. That's what Bodhiprema you did. You started demanding it deep down. And hence you missed it. Next time it will come. This dark night of the soul will not be forever. The morning is coming closer, but when the morning comes closer, the night becomes more and more dark. And one has to pass through it. And when it comes, this time, just enjoy it. And if you just enjoy it, it will become long. It may never go. If you have learned the secret of enjoying a gift, it may never go. I am not saying that it will never go. I am simply saying that if you have learned the art of not desiring, not clinging, not demanding, it may never go. But if it goes, then don't ask, then accept. Then relax in the dark night of the soul again. Many times it happens, because man goes on committing the same mistake again and again. But slowly, slowly, the understanding dawns, and one day one sees the point of it, that God is available if you don't desire. God is available in a desirelessness. If you desire, you lose. The third question, why are there so many religions? Because there are so many people. Because there are so many languages. Because there are so many types of people. And because there are so many ways to approach God, and it is a rich world, it would have been a very poor world if there was only one religion. Just think a world where only Bible lectures and no Vedas and no Gita and no Quran. Think of a world where only Quran exists. Now, one friend goes on asking every day, why I don't speak on Quran? I don't speak for a certain reason. Quran is a beautiful song. The music of it is ultimate. But there is nothing to discuss about in it. That way it is poor. You cannot sing Buddha's message, but you can discuss it. That way it is rich. Buddha's message can be discussed. You can go upon layer, deeper and deeper and deeper, and there is no end to it. But you cannot sing it. That way it is dry. You cannot put it to music. You cannot make a melody of it. But it has great philosophical insight. Quran is beautiful as a song. It has to be sung to know. But as far as insight is concerned, it is poor. There is no insight in it. That's why I don't discuss about it, because there is nothing to discuss in it. And if I have to discuss, I will have to say many things against it. Because Quran is not a pure religious book. It has politics, it has sociology, the society, the law, the marriage. It is the whole code. Only 5% of it is religious. 95% is about other things. Because it is the only book of the Arab people. It is just like the Vedas. Only few sentences here and there reach to the peak. Other sentences are ordinary. Because that was the only book the Aryans had. It was their all. Their science was in it, whatsoever a science existed in those days. Their religion was in it, their philosophy was in it, their poetry was in it, their business was in it, their economics was in it, their agriculture was in it, there was everything. It was their Encyclopedia Britannica. And so is Quran. It is the only book. The Arab people had no other book. So the Quran functioned as their all. It talks about marriage, how many wives a husband should have. It talks about food, what you should eat, what you should not eat. It talks about prayer, the ritual, how you should do it. Now you will not find things like that in Buddha Sutras. They will look so absurd, Buddha talking about how many wives you should have. What Buddha has to do with it? You can have as many as you want, and a wife can have as many husbands she wants. What is the point of talking about it? Buddha is not giving a social code. He is giving the science of spiritual evolution. So when you talk about Buddha, there is so much to talk and go into it. Each word can become a deep well, and you can draw infinite water out of it. But Quran is rich in another sense. It is a poor man's book. Uneducated people, not philosophic, not theological, but people who loved life, who loved the small things of life. It has great song in it. If someday I decide to share Quran with you, then the only way is somebody will have to sing the Quran, and you will listen, and I will also listen, because there is nothing to speak about. If one has to speak about, then there are far beautiful things. Quran should be sung and listened. It is music. It is pure music. It should not be discussed logically. It should not be analyzed logically. Then it looks very poor. You don't analyze music. If you analyze music, it loses its beauty. You don't analyze poetry. If you analyze poetry, it becomes prose. Something has disappeared from it. Then there are ordinary words. You can have all the words that are in Shakespeare. You can have all the words in a box, but not in the same order as they are in Shakespeare. You will not have poetry. The whole art of poetry is those words are put in a certain order, and because of that certain order, something transcendental descends. Those words simply create a net to catch hold of the transcendental. You need not look at the net at all. And if you start analyzing the net, if you cut the net and you see what the net is made of, then you will not catch the transcendental in it. Then the fish of the transcendental will escape. You need not cut and dissect the net. Net has only to be used. So is Quran. It is music, it is poetry. And it is good, I say, that Buddha exists. That is a different approach. And Quran exists, that is another approach. And the Bible exists. And there is Moses and Zarathustra and Jesus. Different people bring different angles into the world. They open different windows into God. It is perfectly good that there are so many religions. Nothing is wrong in it. If something is wrong, then it comes from arrogance, not from many religions. Then it comes from the arrogance when a Hindu says that only my religion is right. Or when a Jew says that only my religion is right. Or when a Christian says only those who go through Jesus will reach, nobody else. This is arrogance. This is stupidity. This should be dropped. And there are many languages and different ways of expressing things. Two patients at an asylum passed the swimming pool early in the morning. A nurse, thinking she was unobserved at that hour, was bathing in the nude. As she climbed out, one inmate said to the other, "Boy, would not she look good in a bathing suit?" There are different visions. "Hey man," one hippie said to another, "turn on the radio." "Okay," the second hippie answered, and leaning over very close to the radio, he whispered, "I love you." Now, that is the hippie's way of turning things on. Beware, don't say to this Padmaja. If you say to her in her ear, whisper, "I love you," you will turn her off, not on. She is very much afraid of somebody saying to her, "I love you." She is afraid of love. She is afraid of being turned on. The fear that if you are turned on, then you don't know where you are going and what is going to happen. Just 2 days before, she had come to me to tell me about her fear. And I told her, and the people who had gathered for that evening's darshan, that is, spread the rumor in the ashram, that whosoever comes around Padmaja, just come close to her and say into her ear, "I love you." She simply gets shocked when you say, "I love you." Even when I said to her, "I love you," she was shaken. Just the very idea of love, the very word, what to say about the experience, the very word pierces her heart. Now, there are people who are waiting somebody to come and say, "I love you." And there are people who are afraid. Different people, different approaches. And everybody has its own validity. Now, she cannot move on the path of prayer, because there God comes and whispers in your ear, "I love you." Now, that is not for her. She has to go through meditation. Buddha will be her way, not Christ. Because Christ says, "Love is God." That will be difficult for her. That is just as an example I am talking. Everybody has different visions, different dreams, different paths, different experiences. God cannot come alike to everybody. And it is very good that there are so many religions. That means everybody can have his own way. Everybody can choose. This is a rich world. It is not monotonous.